Hello and welcome to Echo Chamber. This is Ed Williams and you're listening to the very first episode of this new podcast, focusing on experimental music practices and in particular, music's power to recall memories and incite deep emotions. My first guest is Sam Mackay, a London-based writer and researcher whose interests include music, aesthetics and post-colonial history. He also co-founded the London Contemporary Music Festival in 2013. It was a real pleasure to chat with Sam, who's also a good friend of mine and with who I share a lot of similar musical experiences, things like being a Edinburgh University graduate and a sometime expat in the thriving experimental music scene in Marseille. The music you'll hear throughout this episode comes from a radio art piece written and produced by Sam and his colleague James Greer, and it's called Major Sporting Event. So without further ado, here is our conversation, the first episode of Echo Chamber with Sam Mackay. Is my educational kind of background similar to yours? Is it similar to what I do?
Well, as you know, it is in many ways quite similar, or at least in a couple of freakishly, coincidentally significant ways, it is very similar. We both studied in the same university department for our undergrads, 1 year apart, or two? Was it 2 years apart?
I think it was 2 years apart.
2 years apart.
I think
maybe.
It was two.
Yeah.
Well, whatever.
Perhaps. That doesn't matter. Anyway, that's another story. But so yeah, in some senses, my background is similar to yours. I think that I think it's interesting that you say that your practice now is so deeply informed, or at least quite deeply informed by what you describe as a classical background, which I guess we can understand. What we can understand by that is a background in notated music and classical training and those kinds of things. Because obviously, in many ways, it seems to me that your practice now marks itself, as with a lot of musicians, describing themselves in terms of experimental music, exploratory music, improvised music, in many ways sort of marks itself out and in distinction from classical music and classical training and the things that we associate with that. But I think that tension between what you take from the classical training and what you perhaps react against is something that a lot of musicians probably deal with and have dealt with in quite interesting ways, as something that I, on the one hand, can identify with, and on the other hand, I find it difficult to. And that's because my music related practices now are not really, well, they're not really practical. They're not practical in the sense of they're not to do with performance or composition, really. I'm just beginning to re-enter a more creative way of thinking about...
Yeah, well, not necessarily doing it yourself, but...
Yeah. And I think, I do write about music, and that's something that I've discovered more and more that I really enjoy, is writing about music, and I love to kind of... I take more and more enjoyment from seeking to kind of trash this notion that you can't write about music, and this kind of cliched notion that writing about music is sort of inherently to restrain it and reduce it and simplify it. I think while that might be true, it's also, writing about music is also something that can be very generative and productive, and so I'm kind of interested in that. But as for the kind of influence of classical music and classical training, I find that a difficult thing to think about, just because although I did learn a few different musical instruments from the age, particularly between the age of about 11 and 18, and carried on playing fairly seriously until the age of about 22, since then I really haven't done, and I really feel like I've quite sort of definitely left that behind, not as not through some kind of sort of antipathy or dislike of it, but mm-hmm. just through the sense of a real passage towards something else.
Yeah.
And so I did have that classical training, but if I think about how that affects my practice now, I have to think about the fact that my practice has changed so radically because I'm not really performing anymore.
Yeah.
So I don't know how to approach that.
No, well, I think it's very much a parallel to, I was going to say it's a parallel to my kind of direction, because the point for me is that I started out very classical, and through the very like practice of classical theory and you know practice of an instrument, I've now come to like be doing something that superficially seems completely its opposite. And maybe in a similar way, you having had this classical education and kind of typical music education, you've similarly kind of gone to the ends of that, which has led you to actually thinking more about music, which has led you to writing about it, as opposed to like, you know, because you were playing drums, right?
Yeah. I was playing, the first instrument I started playing was a piano, and then I was playing drums for a while, and then I picked, and also the French horn. Mm-hmm. So those were really the three instruments that I've ever kind of taken seriously, I suppose. French horn I played in some orchestras, drums I played in some bands, piano I guess for me the most sort of
grade 5 theory,
that kind of thing, the most I guess the most sort of interesting or sort of creatively important thing I ever did for myself with the piano was composition. I used to spend, you know, at the age of sort of 16, 17, I used to quite often spend at least an hour or two every day just sat in front of the piano improvising things and playing around with ideas. Basically, I was composing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was composing in a completely, well, I was about to say a completely untutored way, although, of course, that's not true because I had already by that point had, you know, 4 or 5 years of very conventional Western classical, ABRSM sort of structured piano teaching. It wasn't completely untutored, but it certainly I hadn't learned to compose in any sort of formal way.
Yeah, you hadn't had like, so that was composition classes. As such.
Important for me, and actually, it's true that in some ways the transition towards what music I'm involved with now is kind of similar to yours, because although I'm not playing, the music that I'm writing about and that I'm involved with or have been involved with sort of in what you might call a curatorial way is sort of comparable to the kinds of music that you're involved with.
Yeah.
And so I guess it is interesting to think about how I got there, how I became interested, or how those of us who are interested in that kind of music become interested in it.
Yeah,
and actually,
yeah.
One of the things that occurred to me is that, well, one of the things that just occurred to me is how different it obviously is for those who arrive at that kind of music from a fine art background, for example.
Yeah.
And there are plenty of people who do take that.
Oh, who come to this music from having done fine arts?
That's the impression I get, right? And how much of an impact that has on the difference between their perspective and the perspective of, say, people like us.
Yeah, that makes me think of two things. First of all, that most musicians don't understand, or I would say more like don't want to understand how other musicians like us can get to what we're doing.
Mm.
Because it seems, you know, kind of sacrilegious to some.
Mm.
And that also makes me think of, apparently, how, like, in fine art schools, at least in France, there are a couple that have sound departments.
Yeah.
So, you know, these are people focusing on sound installations and stuff.
Yeah.
And to what degree they insist that what they're doing isn't music. It's sound. They're not musicians, they're sound artists. So, you know, I would put at least myself in the crossroad of that.
Yeah, that's... yeah.
Like you say, coming in contact with more visual artists, and they seem to be interested in... I guess they seem to be interested in the music that we do, that we're involved in, because they don't see it as music. And it's for that very same reason that lots of classical musicians don't want to get involved, because they don't see it as music.
I see what you mean. I think that... I think it's interesting to think about in this kind of historical moment with the kinds of music that we're interested in, how porous and uncertain the boundaries between music and sound art and I don't know, I'm trying to think of other sort of categories that are often bandied around, but none occur to me at the moment, but how porous those boundaries are. And I think that people kind of know that they're porous, and they still kind of cling on to certain terms because they perhaps feel that one term gives an emphasis on one thing or another. I guess that, you know, the question of performance is something that comes into it quite a lot. You know, we don't tend to think of sound art as something which is performed, whereas music, you know, usually is. That's one way in which that distinction is made.
There's that thing of music being distinguished as a performing art, right? Like it's, you know, academically classed with drama, music and drama. You know, that's something that always seems to go together in academic categories. With sound art, well, the first thing I use as an example is sound installations. So that's, you know, that's often what happens. If you do have some kind of performance in sound art, well, then it kind of becomes dance, doesn't it? You have bodies moving in space and sound moving in space, and, you know, all these kind of...
Or it becomes performance art or live art.
Or performance art. Or it recedes back into music for accompaniment to dance, for example. And that's again where, more specifically, free improvisation is very kind of difficult to categorize, really, because, like, what is the role of the audience? And, you know, you do get, when playing concerts, you do sometimes get the remark that, like, well, you know, we, the audience, could just not be there, and it seems like you just do what you're doing anyway.
I wonder if that's really unique to free improvisation, though.
Well, yeah, I mean, you could say, well, what about orchestras? You know, they're not doing it for you,
really. Yeah.
Are they? They're
Yeah, I think that all kinds of music can, or many different kinds of music can end up, you know, or can exist in, can be performed in ways that end up feeling detached from their audience. And in, obviously in some cases that's seen as a really terrible thing, certainly for most types of pop music that's seen as a really bad thing if you don't connect with your audience. Then of course if you're an electroacoustic composer, it's an asset, because you're not going to sort of turn up on stage before a diffusion and kind of sort of flourish around with your hands to make it look like a performance. If you can sort of connect with your audience, that's actually very often seen as a that I think the assumption is very often that will be seen as a bad thing to do, or as a kind of
to like sit inappropriate in front of everybody thing to do. And yeah, so then that comes back to the whole sound installation thing, like if you have everything worked out on a computer already, you know, even down to the live spatialization of what's the proper English term for that? Can you say spatialization?
Yeah, yeah. We can,
the you know, live spatialization of sound objects and all that stuff. Like, you don't need to do it yourself. You can do it with Macs or whatever.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, like, the whole French electroacoustic school would definitely not agree with that.
Mm. As in, they would insist on live diffusion
with a central person, preferably the composer, but it could be basically a kind of conductor, interpreter, who is spatializing the sound with his own hands with a mixing desk. I don't know if that's big in other countries or if it is just a kind of post-Schaeferian French thing, which kind of oddly makes one think of Boulez and conductors again, this kind of, I'm the central person, and, you know, okay, we're listening to sound coming out of speakers, but I'm, you know, there's still a person involved at the core of it, literally.
And the person somehow sort of taking responsibility for it.
Whereas you go into, you know, Whitechapel Gallery, for example, and see some sound installation, you walk around the room, and it's a very, very, very different feeling because it's not a performance. You can walk around, you can kind of zone out if you want, you can leave. And that changes the whole dynamic of what the actual piece is. You know, is there a beginning, middle, and end? There can't really be.
Also, the environment suddenly takes on a. Seems to me that in sound installation, the environment takes on a huge importance.
Whereas,
I feel like in electroacoustic music, there's very often a sense of an idealized listening environment, of an ideal listening environment. And it's kind of universalized, and it's almost like the concert hall as laboratory, as in, like, we know exactly what conditions this should be listened to in, and that's what we're going to try and get as close to as possible.
It's very, in fact, it requires, this is in what it connects so deeply to, you know, classical music, or that much better French term, musique savante. I don't know really how to call that, but like,
that's the beauty of untranslatable
things, I guess. You know, learned music,
right,
you know, quotes, etc.
I mean, it's funny because that's a term that sounds very snobbish in English, but I wonder, do you know what kind of connotations musique savante has in France?
I don't really know, because I've always been in the circles of people that
who would use it are in without that any
and would use it with no, you know,
and wouldn't feel uncomfortable using it.
I've never, like, you
it's
know
funny, isn't it?
Talk to a Marseille hip-hopper about music savant and asked him, like, does he think it's a load of bullshit, or
it was a legitimate term.
You know, it has its problems too, because it's like, well, everything is requires learning and
right, exactly, and there's no such thing as musique débile,
it implies musique débile on the other side, which is, you know, everything else. And again, this is the thing, is the with musique savant you have this closed in Albert Hall style, ideally concert hall, you know, where you have sound happening in that thing, and every sound that is in that space is controlled by the kind of almighty composer, conductor, person. The audience is around, and they are completely, you know, subdued to the awe of the music. And you don't hear the sirens outside in the street, and you don't hear, you know, the alcoholic banging at the door shouting at the concierge, like, no, that's, you know, the ideal is that it's this kind of vacuum of sound, like you were saying, and, you know, electroacoustic music, by God, like, it has to exist in that realm, otherwise it's just like, you might as well just sit outside in the street and listen to the sounds, because, you know, you're using the same kind of material all the time.
And I've had a few experiences of organizing public events featuring electroacoustic music in pretty by the standards of electroacoustic music, pretty unconventional spaces, car park and a derelict factory space, and on both occasions, you know, we were working with people who are really flexible and interested in the whole concept and really up for the whole concept, but of course, the exactly these kinds of issues did come up, and it was challenging and also fascinating to work through those. Very revealing, I suppose, is what it was. Revealing about what kinds of things those working in particular musical domains feel are important, what kinds of things they prioritise and what things they don't prioritise.
Yeah. There's so many things to say.
Yeah. I feel funny about... I guess that we've been talking a little bit about musical terms, about terms for the kinds of music that we're interested in and that we're not interested in or that other people are interested in. And, it seems to me that a lot of people put forward this idea that we should be trying to get out of using terms and using sort of categories to describe the kinds of music that we do and the kinds of practices that we're involved in. And I think that's true on the one hand, but I also think that as humans, we need to be able to, we have this dualism or this kind of, this double tendency, this double impulse, on the one hand to try and rationalize and categorize the things we do in order to try and make sense of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, to resist those categories in order to try and achieve some feeling of innovation or freedom or...
Well, it's like constantly, it's kind of like building a staircase, that you're constantly trying to categorize things or, you know, to use the image, like build a kind of solid, flat...
Mm.
understandable ground on which to stand,
mm.
in order only to then make a new step and get past this mm. this first step. So
I like that image, and I think it's a. I also think it's quite a utopian image.
Yeah,
because
always
it's really,
higher,
it's
always better.
Always higher, always better. Always progressing, always moving mm-hmm. forwards. And of course, you know, that's that way of thinking about, you know, change, whether it's in music or in society or the world or whatever, is something that's come under, it's a way of thinking that's come under a lot of strain
mm.
in the last like 30 to 40 years
mm.
For lots of interesting reasons, and now seems perhaps to be making a little bit of a comeback.
What is interesting with that idea there of you know, different types of music trying to break away from the categories but nevertheless it making a comeback
mm.
is exactly that it seems like you were saying that it's kind of human nature to need to categorize things
mm.
to understand them, you know,
mm.
the best example in kind of experimental spheres anyways, Derek Bailey's non-idiomatic
mm.
improvisation, which, you know, after I don't even know how much time, but not very long time, a couple of years, became an idiom in itself.
Yeah.
Became a style.
Mm.
And you listen to Derek Bailey and you're like, oh yeah, that's Derek Bailey. Like,
yeah.
But hang on,
yeah.
that you recognize him because of certain
yeah.
language that he's using, i.e. idioms, and he can't escape sounding like Derek Bailey because he's
yeah.
Derek Bailey.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're Derek Bailey's student, you're gonna, obviously that's gonna rub off on you too.
Yeah.
And, you know, then you get purists that are like, this is improvised music and this isn't. And you think, well,
mm,
you know.
Mm, mm. Yeah, that's very, yeah, it's fascinating. And I guess at the same time, there's also this contradiction between being an artist or being somebody who's involved in music and perhaps having this impulse to resist categorization, to resist the categorization of what we do or what we're interested in. And on the other hand, existing in a social world, existing in a socio-professional world in which there are sort of social and economic relations that sustain our practice,
yeah.
and allow us to carry on doing what
we
do,
have to
and that
spell out.
Yeah, or we have to be prepared to be spelled out by others,
yeah.
even if we're not very willing to spell ourselves out, and I think that's, you know, that's a contradiction that a lot of artists sort of occupy. Yeah. And I don't think it's a very serious one, but I think it's an interesting one.
Well, I think it's a classic example of, you know, should it be a problem? Should it present a problem to an artist to be described as, you know, a free improvisation artist, whereas actually they'd prefer to be, you know, called something else. That's a classic example of that other thing people do, which is get really worked up about words. And labels and stuff. And you think, well, but how else are we supposed to communicate, you know, simply? I mean, it's things will always get boiled down. You know, I kind of have no qualms about saying to, you know, kind of people that aren't so used to hearing this kind of music, to tell them that the music I do sounds weird. Because, like, it does. It sounds really strange. And, like, that, you know, it's refreshing for myself to be able to say that, because I have to kind of take my head out of the sand or something. Yeah. That's not the right metaphor. It requires, you know, taking on the view of other people. And that's fine, you know, like, but then everything's weird is the kind of underthought that I'm not able to explain.
Yeah. Can we talk more about this idea of strangeness totally. In music? Because totally. I think that it's interesting that you say it does sound strange. Do you think that strangeness is something that you aim for, and do you think that I guess what I'm trying to ask is whether strangeness as you the improviser apprehend it is something that you would aim for, as in surprising yourself?
Well, that's kind of two different things. I mean, strangeness, right. I see as it's very stylized. That makes me think of, like, for example, Marilyn Manson. He'll be like, I'm super, you know, crazy and out there and extreme. Yeah. You know, he's making pop music. He's not actually... it's an image. And I guess that's my point, is that when I say to somebody, you know, I'll only say to somebody who's kind of uninitiated and probably doesn't really care. Just say to them, it's strange, just to kind of, you know, not put them off, but
prepare them somehow.
because, you know, to a layman, it is, you know, it's unusual at the very least. But, you know, I don't think, oh, this is really weird, why am I doing this? Like, I know exactly why I'm doing this. And I think strange implies the unknown. And for me, this is completely not unknown.
So do you think that with your work, there's a basic principle of wanting to have a mastery over what you produce sonically, wanting to have total control.
Yeah, totally, and that's so vital, particularly to improvisation, because you have to be in the moment all the time to make it good.
Well, but isn't there then a certain contradiction between that and the whole principle of an experiment?
Yeah, sure, but before you start an experiment, you have to know the potential outcomes, or you have to have examined the potential outcomes, at least theorized the potential outcomes. I think, well, what it's been teaching me, this practice, what it's been showing me by doing it, is that it's especially when you do prepare yourself for any outcome, that you in fact come back to what you know best, and you become more responsive. It's kind of like I don't know, closing your eyes. You know, if all the lights suddenly went out, we're downstairs, there are no windows. I don't know these corridors. Like, I remember, kind of, it's to the left, but I'll be like, you know, I'll be on tenterhooks physically. I'll be like, shit, I really need to kind of. So I'll be using all my forces. I'll be using all my knowledge. I'll be using all my memory to how to get back out and upstairs. Hoping, you know, doors haven't been locked or something in the meantime. And, you know, maybe there's a little undercurrent of thought of thinking, okay, what would I do if I was trapped here all night? Okay, well, I think there are some toilets in there, just in case, like, you know, so I think that's the same, it's a similar process going on when you stand, another important point, with other musicians. So this is, we're not talking about solo as such, are we?
No, it's true, of course.
When you stand in front of an audience with other musicians, you're like, I have no idea how this is going to start. I have no idea if this is going to end badly. Like, you know. And you get into this kind of survival mode, I think, of like super alertness. Through the very fact of kind of putting yourself in a situation where you're not supposed to know what's going to happen.
Yeah,
that's what I like about improvised performance. That's what I find experimental about it. It's kind of like you're trying to prove yourself right somewhere, in the same way that an experiment, a scientific experiment, I mean, from what I've understood of how they kind of happen, is that, you know, a scientist has a theory, and he's like, I think if we do this and this and this, then this outcome will happen. And, you know, then they do experiments, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
I think one of the things that has always made me apprehensive about getting involved in improvised music myself, could, you know, notwithstanding the fact that in many ways it really appeals to me, and something about the something about the openness of it as a practice, the potential openness of it as a practice, really appeals to me. Notwithstanding that, what makes one of the things that makes me apprehensive is about what happens to the idea of creating work. I guess that so much of what I guess that a lot of what I do, and certainly the sort of more or less, or at least vaguely creative things that I do at the moment, are all are mostly based on writing things or putting things together that then happen. As in, it always involves a process of devising something, revising it, and then presenting it as a finished. Work, whether it's a bit of writing or a public event, a music event. I mean, those are very different things, but I guess that my point is that in both domains, I'm doing things that that have a fixed, relatively stable outcome.
Yeah,
that can then be, you know, interpreted in different ways by different people. If for those who bother to, for those who end up in sort of engaging with it and coming into contact with it, whereas somehow with improvisation, there's a sense of letting go of that completely, and of saying, well, however much you practice or think about something, you have to be prepared for the idea that an improvisation, you know, a time-bound improvisatory performance, if you use the word performance, a performance that you do exists then in that moment and is never going to happen again, and is not really cannot really be worked on in the same way.
Well,
refined or revised. I mean, of course, your practice can be revised, but it's something fluid and constantly changing, rather than a corpus of discrete works that you're building up.
So I've noticed that a lot of improvisers, they have several different projects, which seem to change a lot, and you never really have many projects where, like, a trio, for example, they release 10 albums like a rock band might. What you get is, Jacques Demierre, Urs Langhuber, and Bar Philippe, Bar Phillips, singing in the French way. They have a trio. They've been, like, together as a trio for, like, I don't know, years and years and years and years. they're not always active as a trio. They've got a couple albums, I think. I don't really know. They certainly play a lot together, but then, you know, each one has got like tens of other projects on the side in which they're playing differently. It's not just like Barfilips has his improvisational voice the way Boulez has his compositional voice and like kind of like a brand, and this is what I do all the time. No, there will be slight variations with every project. So it's almost like every project is a piece in itself.
It's a voice in itself, or a piece?
A piece.
A piece that's kind of that somehow exists through time. It exists sort of transhistoric, exists kind of.
Yeah, it could be over mutable, you know, several albums, over a tour or something. But like,
But within, so it's sort of like within each formation, a group of improvisers might be doing something that is consistent enough.
Yeah, to call it.
To kind of think about it in terms of in the same sort of way that we would think about a composerly voice or
yeah,
voice.
I mean, say the tour that I did this year in April with Tandem, that by the end of the tour we definitely had like a sound that we, you know, were kind of refining without realizing for the last 5, 6, 7 shows. And it was almost as if we were playing the same piece every night. Yeah, that's kind of interesting, but then, you know, why not just write a piece of music instead? And I guess the point is, with an improvised group, is that there is supposed to be this kind of element of chance. But at the same time, a mastering of a certain type of voice.
Mastery over what kinds of sounds you're potentially going to produce.
Well, I think it's part of the mentality of cutting away as opposed to adding. That is, okay, we're in this moment that we're going to say is free. We don't know what's going to happen and all that stuff. Therefore, like, you know, to make sure we don't mess it up, let's think about certain things only.
Yeah.
And not just anything, because, you know, then literally anything can happen. That's...
I guess an element of that, of the contrast between those two experiences that you're talking about, is also to do with your own subject position, in the sense that you were involved personally with these events, the sort of multiversal events. I'm not to say that the contrast that you're identifying is not meaningful, because obviously it is, but I think it's also interesting to think about what kind of impact the externalities have, as we might call them, like the things that aren't perhaps to do with the music. We might say they're not to do with the music itself, as in they're to do with where the music's happening, what the sort of institutional setting is, and therefore what our expectations, you know, how the institutional setting shapes our expectations, how the environment shapes our expectations, and also how a whole bunch of other things shape our expectations.
Yeah, that's obviously a super, super important aspect to all of this, to everything, especially every artistic.
Every
artistic, spiritual kind of of experience.
And perhaps it's of a special kind of importance with improvised music, simply because there might be less, you know, there's a less fixed or stable sense of what the music is than there is with notated music, certainly, and with the performance of performances by groups who have songs that they've written and recorded, etc., etc. You know, in those kinds of performances, there's something consistent and fixed and stable that transcends the different settings where it might happen.
It'll try to transform the different settings.
Yeah, that's true.
So,
yeah.
Like Liszt insisting on silence before his concerts.
Mm.
He knows he's amazing. Like everybody, you know, knew about him. He had this reputation as well.
Mm.
So you know, he's gonna require that you're silent in order to kind of amaze you with his stuff.
Mm.
He knows that he's going to do well. You're hoping he's going to, you know,
yeah,
amaze you. In exactly the same way, but in a completely opposite environment. You know, you go to a gig of, like, I don't know, Radiohead or something, a huge rock band. You'll go to a huge stadium to see them. And everybody's super excited. And, like, you know it's probably going to be pretty awesome because you know they have a lot of experience. They're masters of what they do, and it kind of requires you to be in a huge crowd all screaming for it to be awesome.
Yeah,
you know, in the same way that it requires you to be completely silent to listen to Liszt to fully appreciate him.
Yeah,
and improvisation's in this awkward between of, you know, this kind of utopist, like, everything is sound, everything is music, like, we can all do what we want.
Mm. And we're no longer shackled by the score or whatever.
We're no longer shackled by the score, the audience isn't shackled by, you know, seats and having to not clap between movements.
Yeah.
And at the same time, like, it's so tied to the moment.
Mm.
That it requires your full concentration. It requires the musician's full concentration and it requires the audience's full concentration.
Mm.
I think that's partly why I have never gotten into buying recordings of or listening to much improvised music at home, because it's like, well, you know, I'm not going to turn off my phone to listen to a CD in my room.
Yeah,
And maybe my computer's open, you know, I'll check an email, and then, you know, well, it's gone. My concentration's gone.
Mm.
Whereas sitting in a concert with the musicians right in front of you, like, you know, you'd have to really have a good reason to get up and start talking to somebody or something.
So there's a sense that it focuses the mind for...
Well, that your mind should be focused in order to really appreciate it. It has to be focused. Yeah. And so that then comes back to the musician kind of forcing their environment on the audience.
Mm.
You know, which kind of goes against everything that this quote-unquote free music is supposedly about.
Mm.
But how can it be otherwise?
Right, right.
Coming back to using a word like strange, or using having to use words, labels in general, it's inevitable because we like to categorize things, and it also kind of doesn't really matter. You know, because this type of music is supposed to be taking everything we've learnt from past musical styles, I think.
Mm.
Taking everything we've learnt from these styles, which involves simultaneously, you know, refuting them and going beyond them.
Mm.
It doesn't really matter what label we end up putting on it. It's the, you know, it's the sound that counts. It's the it's the moment that counts. But you know, yeah, that moment can be completely ruined, as I've also experienced, by people just not kind of taking notice.
I guess that, like, in a way that people who are involved in improvised music, it may be that the term improvised music is a less problematic term than, is a less problematic term than terms like, I don't know, contemporary music or experimental music, in the sense that those are terms which are very contested and contentious and potentially misused, and whereas it seems to me that improvised music refers to something pretty clear, and that's, you know, maybe that's useful. At the same time, of course, with improvised music, there's always a question of absolute versus relative. You know, by improvised music, do we mean that the degree of improvisation is total and absolute, which of course it can never completely be. Or do we mean that it's, you know, do we accept that, or
we know, I guess. People understand it better once they start listening.
Right.
Once they start listening to the music. And some people... it always seems to affect people strongly one way or another. Either they, you know, they can't stand it.
Mm.
Or, and this is nice when it happens, you know, to people that don't... You know, aren't usually into this kind of thing.
Mm.
They'll say after a concert or whatever, like, you know, wow, first of all, I didn't really know that music existed, and second of all, like, you know, that was insane, that was amazing, it was intense and stuff, and you think, oh, awesome.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just, like, music nerds, basically, that are into it, that can understand it. You don't need all this, you know, education and music savant to get to this point of feeling the same thing, and that's, you know, that's the ideal, isn't it, to communicate this kind of essence. And I think this music, whatever it's called, instant composition, free improvisation, that's an interesting term too, isn't it, instant composition, whatever it is, whatever it's called, you know, when it works, it's just the most amazing thing. You know, you can really achieve, people can really achieve the same kind of huge, overwhelming catharsis that, you know, Wagner hoped for, and his music must have achieved in the right kind of performance of any of his music. You know, non-Wagner musicians can achieve this just by being in the zone and being really in tune with their environment and the other musicians around them and the people listening to them, I think. And that's not just through learning, you know, to play your instrument correctly. That's through being interested in life. That's through being interested in something beyond music, beyond types of music, beyond, you know, this thing that we want to categorize as an art form. And I think this kind of music that we're interested in is a powerful key to that, because it's so hard to, you know, put your finger on it. Like, what is it? Is performance important for it? You know, is it actually kind of composition that's happening in your head in the moment? Is it, you know, whatever? Like it, you know, if any musician can get that moment where you kind of see the light, well, it doesn't really matter what it's called. And I think in order to get to that point, you need to not really care. I think that's an interesting thing about, you know, the best artists in their fields, is that you can't really pin them down to a certain type of music, for example, if we're talking about musicians. Okay, or Beethoven being the classic example, like, he's not romantic,
yeah,
but he totally is.
Yeah.
But he's like, you know, decades before
yeah.
the romantic thing. He's not really classical, though, is he? So, like, what is he? Well, exactly, he's Beethoven, you know, he's that.
Yeah.
Mixture of loads of things, because...
Right, and he's inhabiting a certain rupture
yeah.
With the past through his yeah. work. And so it's the occupation of that. It's the fact of occupying this period and position of breaking through to something else that makes, you know, well, that makes many great artists great.
Movement 3. The profile of the sea, more and more colored. The noise reaches a strident pitch, animated hybrids. The harmonic grid reveals itself, quivering all over. Programmed pulses, a rag of birds, sea waves. Ebbing, the noise of the receding tide.
It does take thinking outside the box to get there, at least for the time being. So, you know, what is it that made you get into this kind of not very obvious artistic form? You know, what else in your life happened to you to make you, I'm not suggesting everybody's traumatized, but it's, you know, it's like
psychological.
If you know, I came to it partly from a kind of rejection I felt from the conservatory, from not really getting anywhere with composition. I realized that also it's because, you know, what I really wanted from composition I couldn't get from composition, and it's what I'm kind of getting more of now in improvised performance. And I think it's the case for most people in this world, is that they, you know, they try the trodden path, and they realize it's not what they thought it was, or you know, it's.
But that's interesting, because that implies a trajectory that involves some sort of refusal, or maybe that's a bit overdramatic, but some sort of like conscious decision to reject a certain musical path.
A lot of people, it's that.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's pretty true. It's definitely not the case for me.
Okay, that was my...
Because I think for me, the way I got into a lot of the music that I'm into now is really a very gradual process of musical discovery.
Yeah.
In the sense that when I was probably 14, I heard some music by Philip Glass for the first time. I think it was Einstein on the Beach, so it wasn't. It was, you know, something on the weirder end of what he does. It wasn't, you know, any of the sort of minimalism by numbers, sort of piano soundtrack bullshit. Although some of that's, you know, got its charms definitely, and it's quite pretty. But it was the much more conceptually bold stuff. Einstein on the Beach in particular. And I remember being really struck by that. And I guess that's an interesting question is for me to think about, is what it was that was interesting about that for me. But it was also relatively accessible. You know, I wasn't forced to endure the full 5 hours of it, which no doubt would have maybe never want to hear it again at that age. But well, yeah, maybe not. But it must have been challenging on one level, but also very exciting in another way, because I was suddenly hearing something totally different, totally new.
Yeah.
But the my point is that for me, that was the beginning of a relatively gradual, slow process that took a really long time, actually, for me to discover the work of other composers, other minimalists, and then other types of work, other post-World War II American music, so Cage, Lamont Young, Drone.
And once you get into that, all these kinds of other things
begin to make sense, bit by bit. And for me, it was really a bit more like that. And I have to say that there are still like plenty of composers that whose music I really struggle with. And I find very unexpected ways of growing to feel that I understand them.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I find that reading a score of some 20th century, some sort of, you know, relatively challenging 20th or 21st century music,
mm-hmm.
will be reading a score while I listen to it will be a way to understand it, even though it's been a long time since I really gave a shit about notation and what not give a shit, but it's been a long time since I really engaged with notation and music theory.
Well, Webern's a good example of that, I think.
Totally. Webern is a brilliant example of that.
I mean,
I've had that experience where I've listened to Webern and thought, God, this is really finding this really tricky, and like, oh, God, this feels so arbitrary, and then you read the score and suddenly the sense of architecture,
that's incredible,
just like pops out of nowhere, the sense of so much, such fine grained precision and control over the material. Emerges
and again, coming back to this context thing, that it's the when you have some background knowledge of the composer or the work itself, or you know, in a similar way, when you enter into a big impressive concert hall, you've been put into a certain space mentally as well as physically, and when you do some, again, where would you, you know about this stuff except in a you know, university or a conservatory music analysis class in the first place. But when you do find out about how Webern made his pieces, then, you know, the context completely changes.
Yeah.
And therefore how you listen to it.
Yeah. And perhaps there's something about just the act of, for me, of reading notation while listening to music that sort of clarifies for me and reminds me that there is a logic behind this. You know, there's a method in the madness, let's say, with a composer like Boulez or even like a composer like Carter, Elliot Carter, or someone like that, somewhere where there's like a real entanglement or a real sort of, from a purely phenomenological point of view as a listener, there's often a sense of a real entanglement and chaos of musical material that once you read notation... Yeah, that once you read the notation, suddenly reveals itself to be a very, very intricately worked out set of musical ideas. And maybe that's something that I should do more, because there are still plenty of composers that I feel I don't really get, and that perhaps I'm able to enjoy and I'm able to sort of appreciate their historical importance, and I'm able to appreciate what they've said about their work, but I'm somehow not able to get excited about it in the same way that I might get excited about another composer. So that's an ongoing project for me. Totally.
I mean, we can link that to the to, you know, the improvisers of today. And how, in the same way that, you know, projects, I feel, are kind of like pieces in themselves, or maybe, you know, a certain album from a certain trio is kind of like a equivalent of one piece by Ligeti and not another, in the same way. Well, then, each artist is like a composer, especially a composer of the second half of the 20th century, where every composer kind of had his own thing, had his own voice, and none of them, at least not the greats, were really taking part in any one particular school of composition. And the importance of identity, the importance of some kind of human context to understand the music. It becomes that much more intriguing when you hear music by somebody and then you find out, Xenakis, you hear his music and you see the guy's face and you find out, he had a bomb thrown in it. That totally makes sense, actually. Sounds like it could have been written by somebody who got a grenade in their face, And Ligeti also, kind of couldn't stand his music in second year uni, for example, but super got into it after, once I studied him.
And his life.
And once I found out about, the music, where his music was coming from, and then heard, some, Hungarian folk music. It's pretty weird sounding stuff, too, it's not very far from Ligeti, really. In a lot of ways. With the paradox again of an improviser kind of wanting this utopia of no brands, no schools, no styles. I mean, this is this is pure music. It's coming from the ether. Who are you and who is she? And you're different people. And that's inevitable, and that just adds to the amazingness of it. When it works.
Do you know the story about the performance that Julius Eastman gave of this John Cage piece, the John Cage songbooks?
Tell me about it.
It's relevant to exactly these kinds of issues.
One of the pieces... Oh, no, this is a performance of Julius Eastman of a John Cage piece.
Of a John Cage piece, yeah. I mean, there's a fairly well-known... It's a fairly well-known story among those who are, familiar with Eastman. And in fact, it's obviously become more a more well-known story since Eastman himself has received a bit more recognition and been discussed a little bit more. By musicologists and by music journalists, etc., etc. And it's a really fascinating story. And basically, what happened is that in the early 1970s, Eastman was he was part of this scheme called the Buffalo Creative Associates. Called the Creative Associates, and it was linked to a lot of composers like Morton Feldman and also John Cage. And the idea was that they were performers and composers who would be workshopping a lot of music and performing a lot of new music, new American music mostly, but also European music. And they became pretty involved with performing John Cage's music of the time. So sort of music from the late 60s, early 70s. And they gave a few performances of his songbooks, which are... It's just this kind of huge compendium of instructions and scores, which give a lot of them give very everyday instructions, like prepare a meal, or perform a lecture, or do this, do that.
Getting to the Fluxus
and
stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, very, very much the kind of the Fluxus sort of dimension of his work. They gave one performance where I can't remember which sections of the songbooks they were doing, but where Eastman ended up or probably decided in advance to interpret it by basically like pretending to give a blowjob to someone, sort of bringing a volunteer in from the audience and doing this very like homoerotic sort of comedy routine, and Cage was in the audience. Obviously, Cage was gay, but hadn't come out.
Spelt it out.
Yeah, and Julius Eastman, on the other hand, was gay and very much had spelt it out.
Okay, right.
And Cage was furious, and Cage was there for the weekend, and they were doing this whole kind of weekend workshops, and he was furious, and it kind of spelt the beginning of the end for Eastman as a performer that the establishment was going to take seriously.
Wow.
He had really sort of shot to fame a few years before and was sort of like tipped to be the next, you know, the big, or one of the big performer interpreters of new music. And after that, he carried on working with some very eminent composers and doing some very eminent things. But, you know, it was a really sort of significant moment for him. And it's a fascinating story in the sense that, I should say that it's a story that that's shrouded in quite a lot of mystery and uncertainty, because although there are plenty of people who have been like interviewed about it who were there, there are some kind of conflicting accounts of what happened. But it's fascinating because I think that it kind of taps in right to the heart of this contradiction with Cage about the question of the ego, the question of human personality.
Saying everything's free and then
deciding that actually if somebody does, actually there are certain kinds of interpretation that are not acceptable and in fact like are not okay at all. And what a lot of people say, and what I'm inclined to think as well, is that Eastman was trying to point out that contradiction. He was trying to say that actually this whole idea of self-effacement, of of getting the ego to, or of kind of of erasing the ego from performance is impossible, is an illusion.
People are people and they have their backgrounds
and therefore accept that. Of course, at the same time, Eastman was somebody who was working through some aspects of his identity that were very sort of difficult for the establishment. He was black and he was gay and he was working out some pretty interesting ways of expressing that and articulating that in a world that was not necessarily prepared for it.
Well, it must have been like the only one. I mean,
yeah.
in that kind of world, at least in kind of academia and stuff. I don't know in what context this was. It must have been something.
Yeah, I mean, this was certainly in a pretty academic context.
University related,
And it was not long after that he kind of decoupled himself or ended up drifting from that more academic world. And so obviously these things were related.
Maybe we could just end with and try to tie things up with a quote from my dad's text.
Oh, great.
Which I think is super interesting, mainly because I don't know if I agree with it or not.
Okay.
And it kind of raises more questions than I think he might have thought it would raise, it could raise. I'll just read it. It's about experimental music. It's one of the kind of few sentences about experimental music at all. So he says, various species of experimental music, quote unquote, various species of experimental music not made of notes might give pleasant listening experiences, but I don't see why every pleasant listening experience has to be called quote-unquote music.
Oh, that's very interesting, slightly enigmatic phrase, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, I know that... I know from the very fact that we never really talked much about what I was doing, that he didn't really get it.
Mm.
I don't think he really... He was interested to see that I was, you know, having gone from figured bass and, you know, classical guitar and stuff, that I was then doing this kind of noisy type strange music.
Mm.
But I don't think that he really thought of that as kind of... yeah, he didn't really get why that might have happened. I don't think he was particularly, like, you know, he found it a problem or was upset or anything. But
Sounds like he thought that it was the type of practice that was capable of producing, as he calls, pleasant listening experiences.
Yeah,
but that actually it perhaps wasn't music.
Yeah, and yeah, that this comes back to and my point of view is. Probably been, you know, shaped a bit by thinking about this in the last couple of weeks, at least. Is you know, what is in a word? What why do we feel that we should call what we're doing music when you know it goes so beyond what we, at least in the West, had grown up to kind of know to be music.
Mm. Well, it doesn't. I mean, in some ways it is, you know, there are some aspects of what you do and what a lot of musical improvisers do that is quite conventional. You use pretty conventional instruments. Not all improvisers do, certainly, but you do, and a lot of people that you play with do.
Yeah.
And use sort of, often quite extended techniques, but not, you know, not really... techniques that it would be that easy to think of as non-musical.
Sure, but why does using a guitar, again, it's funny I even use the word using, why does playing a guitar in an experimental improvisational context, why should that be music? Should it be music because I have a guitar in my hands? Mm.
Well, one answer might be that it should be music because we find it useful and helpful to compare it to things which we would call music. We might find it useful to call it music because the reference points that we use to make sense of it, to evaluate it,
are musical as opposed to
are sort of usually thought to be musical.
Yeah, I mean...
So that's one reason.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, of course we shouldn't feel wedded to any labels, shouldn't feel sort of permanently wedded to any labels for what we do. So just as we shouldn't necessarily feel inclined to call a poem or a novel. It also seems it also seems fair enough to question whether we should call something that might usually be called music. But are there particular reasons why you wonder whether it might not be or might not be a useful
term? Well, I think my dad, at least, okay, well, you know, he's had another quote, I think it's even on the same page, which I just noted underneath, because, right, for him, and again, it's not the clearest sentence, the sound of music is specific in that it contains notes, fixed or unfixed, of discernible pitch. Now, what is the sound of music anyway? I'm not quite sure. That seems like, you know, why not just use the word music?
Well, I think there are reasons why not to use it. I think there's a difference between music and the sound of music. And that's because, you know, as a lot of certain musicologists in recent years have been really keen to argue, you know, music consists of or exists in the form of multiple mediations of itself. It's, music is something which we apprehend in the form of lots of different mediations. It can exist as a written text, a notated form. It can exist as sound, but it's music is also the experience of performance, and it's a whole bunch of other things. It's a whole bunch of sort of social, technological, sort of spatial mediations, and that begins to take us into quite abstract territory in a way. But I do think that your dad is perhaps getting at something kind of important when he makes a distinction between, or when he refers to the sound of music rather than just music.
Yeah, no, I think I take back that kind of objection, because the sentence is, the sound of music is specific in that.
Having said that, the second part of the sentence I find challenging.
Yeah.
Because he refers to this idea of, pitched, sort of discernible pitch.
Discernible pitch. The immediate kind of counter-argument I would have to that is, my battery's running super low. Well, that should last 10 minutes. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way that music is, in the ear of the person who finds music in the sound.
Yeah.
And what I really like about noise music, for example, is that it's not so much that you're finding discernible pitches, but your ear is picking out something that's super pleasant in the noise. What I'm trying to say is, you could argue that there is discernible pitch in everything.
Mm-hmm.
It just takes,
even in white noise,
but especially in unrefined sounds that are maybe not super noisy. But when it's
enough kind of like everyday sounds.
Mm. It just takes kind of an interested ear to pick it out. Mm.
I certainly don't dispute the idea that there's a strong and important linkage between a sense of musicality and the presence of sounds with discernible pitch. I would dispute the idea that the two are kind of inextricable.
Mm-hmm.
I
think I agree with you. There's definitely a very strong element of some kind of discernible pitch in sound, which leads us to find some kind of musicality in it. But that's not all there is. Mm.
Actually, one thing that I've just popped into my mind before your battery runs out. One thing that popped into my mind in relation to the earlier quotation that you gave from your dad, which was interesting in a way for some similar reasons, in that he's obviously coming from a particular perspective, mm-hmm. and it's a pointed and in sort of clever statement, but I don't necessarily agree with it. But one thing. One thing made me think is that it's almost that the opposite is true. In other words, what he says is that free improvisation or experimental music might be capable of producing pleasant listening experiences, but that doesn't mean that it's music. I'd almost be inclined to say the opposite. I would almost be inclined to say it is music, but that doesn't mean that it's always going to produce pleasant listening experiences. I'd say it's music by virtue of the fact that it absolutely presents itself as such.
Yeah, it's setting you up again. This importance of context. It's setting you up in a context, in which you're kind of expecting certain things to happen. You're not expecting to see a baseball game because you're in a concert.
Mm.
Whatever kind of music it is. Mm.
Fair enough. There are examples of experimental music where I could imagine. Even someone like myself, or certainly a lot of people, having quite sort of understandable reasons to doubt whether something is music, where there's perhaps little or even no sonic dimension.
Mm-hmm.
you know, then you start to get really into the domain of thinking, well, can we really sort of credibly be talking about this as music? You know, there are, well, for example, 4 minutes 33 or something like that.
Yeah, you've got everything but the music in a sense. Mm. You've got the context, and what's interesting is to see to what degree the context does influence your kind of your state of mind into a kind of that of an audience for a musical concert.
Mm.
In the same way that, you know, an improvised performance, because supposedly nobody knows what's really going to happen in the performance, you know, an audience member could argue, well, like, what's the point in even kind of paying attention? Because, you know, if they don't know what they're doing, you know, then, which is obviously not really the point. They do know what they're doing. It's just a different approach. Mm. I think it's super interesting to question the very use of the word in music.
Right.
And this idea of sound, of fine arts people doing sound installations, and they're not musicians, they work with sound. And you think, well, you know, but it's nice sound, isn't it? So, and it's organized.
Mm.
So how is it not music, actually?
I think one of the things that I find attractive about the term music is precisely that it seems to me a little bit more, or it has the potential to be a little bit more mysterious and evasive than sound. Like, for me, the use sound of sound
has acoustic properties.
Yeah, it becomes, you know, when you talk about sound and sound art, and we instantly start to think about this kind of division of the senses, the physics, acoustics.
Yeah,
and we start to think about the kind of rational Cartesian domain of Western, you know, the history of knowledge, etc., etc. And somehow music, precisely because, you know, because it has to do with the emotional and everything else, it's a slippery term, and that's precisely its
power.
Its usefulness.
Yeah.
That was episode 1 of Echo Chamber with my guest Sam Mackay. Please feel free to check out the London Contemporary Music Festival's website at lcmf.co.uk, where you can find out more about Sam and his work. If you've enjoyed this discussion, you'll be able to hear more like them by checking out my website, edwilliams.xyz, where I'll be regularly uploading new episodes. As you can imagine, I've put a lot of time and resources into making these interviews happen, so if you think you're able to support me in order to keep up a high standard of research and interviews, please do so and become a patron on my Patreon. There's more information about that on my website too. Finally, if this discussion has resonated with you and you have any particular questions, or if you'd be interested in taking part in one of the next interviews, please get in touch in the About page on my website, or of course through Facebook. Till next time.